Let's start from the very beginning. So what is Mangusta Capital and why you decided to found it? You come from a different financial background, but then you moved to this kind of funding. Why?
Maybe it's helpful to give a little bit of background for you as well as your listeners. So I grew up in Silicon Valley, a first generation Chinese American. My parents immigrated and lived in Silicon Valley. So they were engineers, and I kind of grew up fascinated by everything that was happening there. So I lived in Cupertino, which is the headquarters and birthplace of Apple. And when I decided to kind of take the next steps, I wanted to be in technology. It sparked my interest in innovation and entrepreneurship. So I went to study on the East Coast in the US. I went to Harvard and majored in economics, and then have been working with technology companies ever since. So I started out at Goldman Sachs in their investment banking division, working with tech companies on M&A, IPOs. I worked in private equity for a while as well at one of the largest private equity firms in the world called Apollo. And then for most of my career, I was actually at SoftBank, which is a Japanese company, but globally known as one of the largest venture capital investors in the world that has funded technology innovation for decades. And so I worked directly with our CEO and founder, Masayoshi-san, to invest in global technology businesses. I was part of the founding team at the Vision Fund, which is the $100 billion investment vehicle that he had started alongside a couple of team members in around 2016 and 2017. So I joined the fund very early on as one of the founding investment team members and was there for almost 10 years. And over that period of time, we saw AI and venture capital investing transform entire industries, the entire world, and almost created a new asset class of investing for many different funds and many different companies to become more interested in technology. And so with that, I gained a great experience in terms of investments that we made, building a platform, and was there for almost 10 years. And for me, that was kind of a point at which I felt like I was ready for something new. I had a great run, had a great ride with Masa and the team, and was starting to think about taking a bit of a founder journey myself to do something brand new and build something together. And I see the second wave of AI transformation evolving, which I'm happy to talk about as well, which is really the thesis behind the fund. And I felt like it was the right time to kind of take a new jump. And so about 3 years ago is when I met the my co-founders, one of which is a very prominent Italian family, along with another Italian entrepreneur. And we kind
Who's
of
the other one?
Tommaso Ciabra is the other my other co-founder, and we were able to really come up with the idea for Mangusta as a platform to be able to be the next generation venture capital firm, really pushing the edge of AI investing and becoming a global platform that hopefully will be as well known as a lot of the other Silicon Valley platforms that we see today. And so that's really where I would say the idea for Mangusta came about. And then over those 3 years, we were able to establish some amazing investments, set up the fund officially, and launch about 1 year ago in July of 2024.
So you're brand new, basically. And you often talk about vertical AI. That means that I guess that that's your focus as an investment company, right? Mm-hmm. So what is vertical AI? And why are you focusing on that? Has it more potential than other type of AI? What's involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, look, vertical AI, in our opinion, just to kind of define it a little bit, comes from the idea of vertical software. So everyone knows what a software business is. Essentially, you're selling a application, usually software that's able to provide a lot of functionality, whether it's customer relationships or workflow management or payments. You know, there's a lot of software tools that have become very prominent in the last 10 years. And vertical software just means industry-specific software where, for example, you're working with restaurants, like a company like Toast in the US, which provides specifically restaurant software, restaurant hardware, and digital devices to, like, the POS system where you tap your card onto the system to pay for your meal. That's what, you know, the verticalized industry-specific solutions means in vertical software. We believe that that's going to transform into vertical AI in the next 10 years. And that's the core thesis of the fund, is finding AI technology solutions, whether they're software-based whether they're agents, AI agents, or whether they're hardware, there's some component of hardware in them, or robotics, where AI is really driving vertical solutions or industry-specific solutions using technology, harnessing AI in ways that hasn't been used before. So it's, in our opinion, it's kind of the evolution of potentially vertical software into like vertical AI software. For example, there's now software solutions today in the legal industry where it's similar to like a ChatGPT format where you can type in a question or put in a task and say, hey, I've got this legal contract with 100 pages and I want the AI to be able to tell me, hey, this piece of the contract is typically not something we would accept, or this part of the contract needs to be updated or changed, or automatically make those changes and redline the document and then send it back to whoever you're working with already. So being able to have the AI provide a lot more intelligence, value, and workflow management than previously possible without AI embedded in that software.
You have preferred industries, or you just look at...
We are actually industry agnostic, so we will look at every industry because we believe that every single industry has amazing solutions that we want to be able to invest in. Because even if you think about some of the maybe less sexy or visible industries out there, for example, biotechnology research, there's tons of solutions and $1 billion of market opportunity even within these industries to be able to investigate protein folding or investigate drug discovery using AI software and AI tools that are now being developed by startups and founders that are going to be able to provide potentially billions of dollars of value. And so we don't think there's any sector that's not going to be transformed by AI, and we want to have an open opportunity to really find and invest in any of those sectors.
Talking about finding, you know, the right companies, there is a lot of AI hype these days, and I guess that a lot of founders out there, a lot of companies.
Yep.
How do you spot that those, I'm quoting you, uncut gems that you're looking for?
It's a good question. So for me, having been at SoftBank for, you know, a decade, I really focus on a couple of key things that I look for when I meet founders. You know, you can say that there's a gut feeling of like, oh, this person is someone that you like or dislike, but really there is a little bit more systematic, I would say, process and rubric of things that I'm looking for. A couple of things. The first and most important is always the level of hunger, ambition, and drive that a founder has. And the more time you spend with someone, I think the more that you can feel whether they have what it takes to truly make a startup or a company successful, because you see how much they prioritize, how hard they work, what drives them, what motivates them, how much really deep ambition do they have within their heart. And you know, as you may know, startups and being a founder is not an easy thing. It takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of sacrifice. And so when I spend time with founders, you know, at this point I can pretty quickly assess how I feel about them with regards to that. But the more time you typically spend with someone, the more of a sense you'll get on that piece of the element or that piece of the personality. I think the second thing I typically look for is someone that has been a repeat founder or a serial entrepreneur. Not to say that we don't invest in first-time founders, but I do like to find folks that have had experience, because once you have started a company, maybe it's failed or maybe it was a small exit, you have a better understanding of all the different pieces that it takes to be able to build out that company. You know the mistakes that you make along the way, what you should avoid. And then finally, after a period of time, you know what it takes to grow fast as well, and what it takes to scale, fundraising. All these things are very complicated elements that, you know, we want to be able to make sure that the founders that we work with are actually able to really navigate that journey relatively smoothly because they've done it before. And so that's something that I would say we do typically look for as well. And then the third thing I would say I look for is actually the ability to build a team that is potentially better than what the founder is able to do himself. And so really being humble, having a low ego, and bringing in people and ideas that they're willing to take in those ideas and actions and implement those because they have the humility of knowing what they can do and what they need help with or what they can't do. And so that's also an interesting balance of figuring out, okay, is this person genuine? Are they transparent? Are they honest? Do they know what they lack and what they're good at? And so that's another kind of like self-understanding that is very important to see that a founder and entrepreneur is able to really embrace that and then build an amazing team and support system around themselves. And so those are the three key things I would say when I evaluate founders and teams, how I think about what we really want to look for in entrepreneurs.
Oh, that's very interesting because you mentioned the personal qualities, basically. You said, I see the founder, the hunger he has, if he is a repeat founder, you know, the team he built up. So it's not about the product. I think that's quite remarkable, at least for me.
I thought the question was, what do I look for in terms of the team? So that's why I said,
I meant also, you know, sometimes you see, like, you know, startups that are valued at billion and they don't even have a product. So why I thought that, you know, the personal side.
Let me answer your real question. Your real question is, how do I evaluate investments or companies generally? So that is a broader question. So there's four, I call it the four M's, like Mangusta, four M's. Market, model, management, money. So those are the four M's. Market is understanding the size of the market, how large it is, how fast it's growing, is it competitive, is it fragmented, is it a market that we think is attractive or not. Second is model, business model. What does the profit and income statement look like? What is the revenue? What does the revenue look like? Is it growing fast? Is there good profitability margin? Is it profitable? Is it burning a lot of cash? Does it have a lot of hardware? Does it need a lot of capital expenditure to invest in the business? So very capital intensive. That's model. Third is management. I walked through management in detail because I thought that was your question. But all the things that I mentioned on management, team, founder, mindset, all that stuff. And the final one is money. Money is the terms of the deal. So what's the valuation? What are the terms of the shares that we're purchasing? Are they preferred shares? Are they another instrument, a safe note? Are they common shares? Who else is investing in the round? Who's leading the round? Is it Sequoia? Is it Andreessen? Is it a big firm that we trust? Are the existing investors also investing in the round as well, or do they not want to put additional money into the company? That's usually a signal as well. So that's the fourth one, is money. So the four M's is holistically how I look at investing and analyzing an investment opportunity.
So you talk about the business model, but sometimes, I mean, do you invest in just ideas?
Typically, we don't. So what you're talking about is kind of like a very early stage, what we call kind of like a pre-seed or an idea stage kind of investment stage. We don't do a lot of pre-seeds. We've done maybe two out of our total portfolio of around 20 or so companies that we'll have in the fund. And so it's not something that we do very often, but we will do that only when we've known the founder and that entrepreneur and their track record for a very long period of time. So the two that we have done that are folks that I've known for 5-6 years. They've been very close friends or people that I've followed their career and know what they're capable of. We will sometimes make very early stage investments like that. But most of the time when we're looking at seed stage or Series A investments, which is our sweet spot, we are looking for companies that have revenue traction, that have a product, that have generally have already built out a business, and we like to see that there's product market fit, and then they just need to scale that to the next level. That's typically where we get excited and where we want to be investing.
Okay, out of curiosity, you said that the more you get to know a founder, you know, the more you appreciate certain qualities. But when you invest on a startup, on a vertical AI startup, how much time do you spend with someone typically?
Yes.
I don't know if there's something.
It's a good question. I will say it varies depending on the situation. So sometimes when there's a deal that's moving very, very quickly, say there is a big lead that has decided to invest in the company, like a Lightspeed or Sequoia, they will typically close those rounds very quickly. So it may only be a week or 2 weeks or a month that you have to really come to a decision whether you want to participate or not. And even the allocation of getting dollars, you know, getting the ability to invest in that round is sometimes very competitive, so that it's hard to even get into the round if it's only like, say, the company is raising $5 million. The, you know, large firms may want to just take the entire round, and the company doesn't want to raise any more than five they may just say, sorry, there's no more space, you cannot invest. And so it's often in those situations where you actually have to also make an effort to justify why you should be allowed to invest in that company. And so that's something that, you know, for us, we have a lot of strategic benefits through our ecosystem, through our investors, through we are able to provide to the companies to hopefully convince them they should allow us to invest in that round. But ultimately, sometimes if it's a very competitive round, it can be gone in 1 week to a month. And then sometimes you have the ability to spend a bit more time, right? So, you know, in those short processes, I might only be able to spend a couple hours with the founders. I'll do a Zoom call. I'll spend time with them in person. I'll go to the office and meet the team. Maybe I can only spend a week or two on diligence before we get to a point where we have to make a decision. On the other situations, I may have 2, 3, 4 months where I can track the companies. For example, if the company is in an early stage, I can often track them for a year and see, okay, I met them when they just started the company, they didn't have a product or anything yet, but now a year later, they've developed a product, they have a team, they've sold some, they have some customers now. So then I can actually track them over a course of a year, and that makes it better for me as well because I have more data and information that I can use to base my decision, investment decision on. Sometimes if someone's raising and their process is not moving super quickly, they don't have a lead that stepped in to lead the round, their process may also take a bit longer. It could take 2, 3, 4 months. In those situations, we have a little bit more time to also evaluate the opportunity. I can spend maybe a couple of weeks with the founder, or you know, once every month I go and spend a couple hours with the founders and the team. And so those situations, we have ability to really spend more time diligencing and analyzing the company, the product, and getting to know them over a longer period of time, which I generally do like. But sometimes you want to be careful of those, because if a deal doesn't move very quickly, it means that there might not be a lot of demand from other investors for that opportunity as well. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword when you think about timing, how quickly a deal moves, and how desirable that opportunity may be.
Interesting what you're saying, because I've always thought that basically the startup companies were striving to find someone financing their ideas, but in reality it's like a two-way process. So mm-hmm. you choose the company, but
sometimes
maybe
the company
is in the position of choosing.
Absolutely.
Yes, very much so.
I would say more often than not in Silicon Valley, for those really, really, you know, top companies, that is the case. They are choosing the investor. The investor is not choosing the company. But, you know, I guess what I will say, that's pretty rare.
Okay.
Most of the time, unless you are a really amazing founder with a very, very strong track record, you're able to do that. For probably, I don't know, 80%, 90% of the companies out there, startups, they're not choosing who their investors are going to be.
Okay, yeah. Going back to the sectors, I mean, you said you are agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
I liked very, very much the
yeah.
term that you used. But there are like sectors that are more promising than
mm-hmm.
others
yeah.
that you could briefly mention.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a few that we've already seen a lot of big developments come out of. And so it's no surprise probably to folks who have spent some time in AI that legal is one of those. Coding, engineering is also one of those. I would say within kind of autonomous driving and kind of that has certainly been an area which has been developing for probably, you know, 5 to 10 years already. And so the ones that, you know, from a vertical AI perspective that seem to be most promising are, for example, legal, where it's text in, text out. And so naturally it fits well with large language models, which are typically textual based AI models. And so we're able to see that workflow management tools for lawyers and legal counsel is very, very powerful because it can save them hours and hours of time. And there's a lot of lawyers in the world, and they're paid very well, and they work a lot of hours. And so when you think about the amount of value, dollar value that can be delivered using AI technology to improve the productivity, improve automation, that is a huge amount of value that can be delivered. And so legal is certainly one of those. Same thing with engineering, right? Also somewhat textual based. We've seen a lot of companies come up in this space, including names like Cursor or Windsurf that recently got acquired by OpenAI. There's been magic.dev. So there's a lot of startups as well, and now pretty fairly large companies that are tackling coding using AI tools and solutions. And so that's another area that makes a lot of sense, because there's a lot of highly paid coders around the world, and it can often be a more simplified and automated process in a lot of cases. And so those are two areas that we see a lot of attention in and a lot of progress in. But frankly, because we are an early stage investment firm and we focus on seed and series A, a lot of those companies have grown very quickly and already outside of kind of the valuation range that we will typically look at and stage range of what we look at. And so I will say we look at those spaces occasionally, but we also look at other sectors that have not had that much kind of traction yet, because we think there's more opportunity and investable money-making opportunities mm-hmm. across other sectors that are not as mature yet as those.
Let's take a wider perspective.
Sure.
But you mentioned lawyers, they are knowledge workers.
Yes.
And you know, there is like a huge debate on whether, you know, AI is gonna replace mm-hmm. some of those jobs, all of them, or just integrate them. Where do you stand on that?
So my belief is that over the short term, short to medium term, it will be a lot of enhancing human productivity as opposed to replacing humans, right? The very, very basic human kind of tasks, which I wouldn't put legal, lawyers, and coding in, because that's fairly skilled labor, I would say. But the more simple tasks, for example, if there's process automation, right? Someone is just clicking a series of buttons, that can probably be automated by a robot, or by, if it's on a computer, that can probably be automated by AI relatively quickly. Some aspects of potentially customer service, call centers, is something that can be automated completely, especially in certain geographies. For example, from what I understand in Latin America, a lot of people actually don't even know when they're talking to an AI agent. So it, even though it's not a real human, they don't know and they don't really care. And so in certain cases, the simpler kind of labor elements could be automated relatively quickly. But overall, I think for skilled labor, for example, for lawyers, it will take a bit of time to completely automate per se. And so in the beginning, for the next 5-7 years, I think it will be a lot of productivity tools that people, humans, can leverage to make their productivity enhanced by 2 times or 3 times. But then over time, we might get to a point where potentially full automation is possible. We'll have to see that. I think it takes a certain amount of skills and know-how to be able to do a lot of jobs that we have in the world. And certain things around relationship building and sales to some extent may never be automated, because there's always an in-person element that you cannot necessarily fake with an AI.
So last question, and then we are done. Mm-hmm. So you said you grew up in the Silicon Valley,
yeah.
and but you get money from some European families.
Yes.
So as you know, there is like this preconception that, you know, innovation, United States, regulation,
Europe.
So, and you're standing in the middle. How do you see, you know, this kind of relationship between innovation and regulation, being in a way there and here at the same time, if you know
what
I mean?
Yeah, yeah. No. It's a very interesting question. And I feel like, you know, it's a funny thought, because I will tell you, 5 years ago, you know, or even any time in my life before I kind of met my co-founders, I never expected to be spending a lot of time in Europe, in Milan. I've only been to Milan probably 4 or 5 times, and it's only been since I've launched Mangusta with my co-founders. And so it's been a really amazing journey, just getting to know the warmth of the Italians and a lot of Europeans in general. So I've really enjoyed working here and building a lot of connections. But it's an interesting question you ask, which is, I think, a broader one, which is, how do you view innovation and AI and investing across all these different regions, and what do people think? I will say, first, you know, AI, talent, engineering, startups, and venture capital is to some extent very, very Silicon Valley centric, right? There's a lot of capital, there's a lot of talent, there's an ecosystem which pulls a lot of people to Silicon Valley. And so I see it with even entrepreneurs and founders and investors that I meet in Europe. They often think, I want to be in Silicon Valley, and they'll often move to Silicon Valley because it does provide some sustainable advantages that are important. But that said, you know, I think everyone wants to get in on what's going on. And so that's why we found it very successful to be able to raise money and work with a lot of European investors, including the family office that I work with, because of the ability of getting access to that market is sometimes hard unless you have a relationship with existing people in that ecosystem. It is a little bit of a closed ecosystem. And so being able to have boots on the ground is something that, for example, the Delvecchio family is very interested in, is having someone like myself being able to really tell what the color is on the ground, what's going on, what's the latest news, what's the latest developments, what are some of the companies that we're seeing that are developing right on the ground, because that is a very difficult to access ecosystem unless you have an insider that's part of that. And so we see a lot of Europeans that are starting to be more interested in getting access and investing and getting more exposure to that Silicon Valley ecosystem. In addition, you know, there are a lot of founders that are very talented that sometimes we want to be able to expose them to that ecosystem and also bring some of the companies that we work with in the US to expand in Europe as well and find customers, open up offices, because I do think I've seen a lot of initiatives from different European countries and governments to spur innovation and invest in innovation. And so I'm very hopeful that hopefully we can get more of that investment into great startup companies that are building in Europe as well. But I think it will take time just to really spread and connect both of those worlds, because it is a very different ecosystem. If you go to Silicon Valley, you'll be able to see and feel the difference.